Welcome to the RBMS Streaming Podcast, a podcast that explores the stories about the people, the places, and the work within integrated catchment management. My name is Janice Taylor from the River Basin Management Society and your host today. Today's episode, we speak to Wayne Costa from the Arthur Riley Institute. The focus of much of Wayne's recent work relates to the movements and migrations of freshwater fish species and environmental water requirements of native fish. Current projects include main stem tributary dynamics of silver perch and golden perch populations using acoustic telemetry, diadromous fish migrations and links to flows using passive integrated transponder technology, and oceanic migrations of angler-led eels using satellite tracking. Today, we have an eel-good story, a feel-good story, about eels and satellite tracking their migration. Here to tell us more is Wayne Costa. Welcome, Wayne.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today on the RBMS podcast. So part of the RBMS streaming podcast, we're about getting to know the people in integrated catchment management and their journey to date with their career, just for our listeners to get to know you a bit better. Do you mind giving us a bit of an introduction about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I've been working at the Arthur Riley Institute since the late 1990s. It was essentially my first job out of uni, where I studied environmental management. I'd always had an interest in fish, I suppose. I grew up catching fish with my dad in places like the Warriella Creek in the upper Yarra catchment. And I suppose that's what sparked my interest in fish in those early years. And so I went through high school with some sort of ideas around working in a related field and so studied environmental science at uni and then landed a job at the Arthur Riley Institute a little while after finishing up uni studies.
Oh, wow, straight after uni.
Well, a couple of little jobs here and there in between and a few short-term contracts here before I got a more ongoing position. So it took a little while, but it's been my main job ever since I finished uni.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, today we're hoping to talk to you a little bit more about your eel satellite tracking project. So globally, freshwater eels have been or they've been declining due to factors such as things like habitat loss and barriers to migration, development. In Victoria, there's two species of angler-led eels, the long-finned and the short-finned eel, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There's five species found throughout Australia. And two of those species, the short-finned eel and the long-finned eel, are found in Victoria. And they're found not only in Victoria but up the coast into New South Wales and Queensland. The short-finned eel is also found more broadly across into New Zealand and some of the islands in between. So it has a pretty large distribution.
Oh, wow. So with the project, can you tell us a bit about it and what its aims and objectives are that the ARI are trying to achieve? So what's the knowledge gaps that exist and why is it important to fill those?
Yeah, we're using acoustic tracking and satellite tracking to document the migrations of eels. The acoustic tracking is used to understand migrations in freshwater habitats and links to environmental drivers like river flows, water temperature. And then for the satellite tracking, that's where we're looking at their oceanic journey. We're trying to work out where they go, where they end up, and what happens along the way. We have almost no information on their breeding migrations in the ocean. About the only information we have on their breeding in oceans is a handful of collections of larvae that have been collected drifting in the ocean. Prior to this project, that the adults had never been tracked migrating in the ocean.
Well, okay, interesting. So what does the eel life cycle and migration entail? Like, what have you learnt so far about that? Is it about coming down at a certain time of year for breeding or feeding purposes, for them to go up to warmer waters? Like, what do we know?
So in fresh water, the adults will start a journey downstream towards the lower reaches of rivers. That can occur over a broad time frame from spring through to summer and into autumn. And as part of that downstream migration, they undergo a number of changes. They become silver. The eyes enlarge for improved vision, and they develop a counter shading. So development of the silver belly and a dark back, which is thought to help reduce detection by predators. They cease feeding and their digestive organs contract. And so then they'll essentially rely on fat reserves to get them to where they want to go. They then head out into the ocean and undertake a journey up to several thousand kilometres to warm tropical waters off the northeast coast of Australia where they breed. After breeding, the adults die, and then the newly hatched larvae will drift on ocean currents up to around 12 months or so, and eventually they'll find their way into freshwater habitats where they gradually migrate upstream and will spend years and years, even decades, feeding and growing, developing into adults before they make that journey back to those spawning grounds in the warm tropical waters.
Right. So do we generally find them coming back to the same rivers and streams?
No. So they're a little bit different to some fish that do that, like salmon. So when the larvae drift on ocean currents and into fresh water, they're not necessarily recruiting into the streams where their parents came from. They don't undergo that process of natal homing or imprinting like we find in other fish such as salmon.
So how do we then have like the same amount of eels returning to those sort of systems that they originally came from? Like, does those systems then deplete?
No, it's not all of the adults that are going out at the same time. So in any given year, it might only be a small portion of the population of adults that migrate out, and the numbers that do migrate out can vary depending on a range of factors, including environmental conditions. Some of the tracking work that we've done over at Lake Conda, for instance, has shown some quite big differences in the numbers of adults that migrate out in wet seasons compared to dry seasons. So a much higher proportion of adults tends to move out during wetter years, mm-hmm. and fewer migrate out during dry years. But there's always adults in the system, and it's only a part of the population that migrates out in a given year.
Yeah, okay. So how did they fare with the bushfires impacting on habitat?
I'm not sure about specific impacts of bushfires, but certainly dry conditions can impact on eels in terms of changes to rainfall patterns can have an effect by altering cues or triggers for movement, potentially altering the process of silvering. And if you chat to commercial fishers, they'll certainly tell you that in dry years, catches are lower, and in wetter years, catches tend to be higher.
Okay. Yep, fair enough. So how about the technology that you use? How does that satellite tracking and tagging work? Like, what does it sort of record, and what does it require to tag an eel to actually track its movements? Is that quite hard to be able to, is it a nighttime operation? Do you need to go through some thick areas to get in and to actually capture? How easy is it to capture an eel and to tag it?
Catching eels can be quite hard, or catching ones that are big enough to tag can be really hard. So with the satellite tags, we aim for eels that are about 2 kilos in weight, so the biggest ones that we can get. And perhaps for every 50 or 100 eels that we catch, it might only be one or two that are big enough. The way we catch them is usually setting fight nets, which are a funnel type net. They're set in the evening and either into the early hours or overnight. The eels, once they're collected, are then tag with the satellite transmitters that's attached externally to the the dorsal or the top surface of the eel. And those tags will collect data such as depth, temperature, and we program them to pop off after a certain time period, and they then transmit the data that they've collected up to the satellite network. We then get that data back and are able to reconstruct migratory routes and work out what's happened to the eels along the way. And one of the really interesting findings is these sudden changes in temperature, which are recorded by the tags. And from that, we're able to infer predation events. So predation by marine mammals, such as whales, we see a sudden temperature spike up to about 37 degrees, which is approximately the internal temperature of those marine mammals. Or in the case of some of the sharks, we see a temperature spike up to around 24, 25 degrees. And so that tells us that these eels have actually been predated by a predator in the environment. And there actually seems to be quite a high level of predation of migrating eels. So it's a really interesting insight into the linkages between freshwater and marine environments, in that eels that are migrating out of freshwater are playing a role as a food source in those marine ecosystems.
Well, yeah. Well, it made me think just before when you're talking about the satellite, it's like programmed to fall off.
Yeah, that's right. It has like a burn switch or a salt water switch.
Oh.
That gets activated after a set time, which we normally set them to pop off after about 4 to 5, 6 months. It floats up to the surface and then it transmits the data. Sometimes they come off earlier. They come off prematurely for sometimes unknown reasons. Sometimes it's due to predation, and that seems to be a bit of a pervasive problem across tracking studies worldwide, premature release of these tags. But we have been lucky enough to get back some of those tags. They do tend to wash up on beaches, and we've been lucky enough to find some, and it's great to get them back because you can reuse the tag. The tags are worth several thousand dollars, so it's really good to get them back. And you can also extract the entire data set, whereas the data set that's transmitted up to the satellite network, it's often only a part or a portion of the data due to memory constraints, essentially.
Yep. Wow. So you're not generally, you won't get them back. You'll always only have that sort of minor sort of subset of data, as opposed to having the whole collection once you can actually get a satellite tracker back.
Yeah, in terms of getting the tags back, it's usually only a handful that we get back, and the rest just pop up and float around. And they don't always transmit either, which is another issue with these tags. One of the best findings we got was actually a tag that a person had found around Lizard Island off North Queensland. That transmitter had failed to send up any of its data to the satellite network, but someone found it and they sent it back, and we were able to extract the data. And what we could tell from that tag, it had a damaged antenna. And if we look at the temperature plot from the tag, we see this sudden spike up to about 37 degrees. So it's been predated by probably a whale, and that's why the antenna was damaged.
Yeah. Wow, that's fascinating. That's a huge journey as well. Like, what a long way to go.
Yeah, that one was close to 3,000 kilometres. So it's a really long journey over a distance or over a time span of about 5 months. These eels, they're moving at variable speeds, but typically doing about 30 kilometres a day. But they don't all go at the same speed, and they don't all go in the same direction. Some of them seem to head directly east across Bass Strait and then north up the coast, and others head directly south and head around Tasmania. And what we suspect is that route gets them into deeper water off the continental shelf more quickly, and that might be important in terms of avoiding predation. But others go a different way and essentially head east across Bass Strait. So they're not all going the same way, and potentially not all ending up in the same area. So there may be not a single spawning area, but perhaps multiple spawning areas. And some of the work that's been done on European eels around the Sargasso Sea suggests that for those eels, they breed over a pretty big area in the ocean too.
Wow. It's a pretty interesting project. There's a lot of tech involved. What is a passive integrated transponder?
That's different. That's what's referred to as a PIT tag. So similar to the types of microchips that get put in cats and dogs.
Yep.
They work a bit differently to acoustic tags and satellite tags. And essentially the way those tags work is they need to pass over an antenna, and that activates the tag, and it records details of the fish or whatever animal it's been implanted into. We do have another project with Melbourne Water where we're tracking the migrations of a range of diadromous fish. So diadromous fish are ones which migrate between freshwater and marine environments.
Yeah.
We're looking at migrations of eels, tupong, grayling, and common galaxias in the Bunyip and Tarago systems, and we're using those PIT tags for that. So we have a series of readers set up along the length of the Bunyip-Tarago system, and we're looking at migration behaviours of those species and links to river flows. And we've got some great data on the importance of increases in river flows in April and May for migrations of grayling, but also common galaxias. And that's a bit of a first in that previously it's thought that their migrations and their spawning were largely linked to lunar phases, but we've been able to establish in the Tarago system that they're often migrating downstream in that system during small increases in flow in autumn. And then for one of the other species, tupong, it actually migrates downstream a little bit later, so around July, August. But again, it's on these increased flow events. So for a whole range of different migratory fish species, increases in flows are really important to cue their migrations.
Yeah. No, that's definitely very true. Is there any fieldwork fail moments that you've ever had where you've just gone to set out to do part of the project and it's just everything's gone wrong?
Well, spending nights and nights, weeks and weeks, not getting eels big enough to tag feels like a bit of a failure when you're out till 2 or 3 a.m.
Wow.
Every morning, night after night. And it's pretty hard work at times. But sometimes you get absolute pieces of gold, like a tag popping up near New Caledonia. So lots of hard work and sometimes great pieces of information in between.
Yeah, so it makes it all worth it when you get those little nuggets of gold.
Yeah, definitely. I can still remember looking at the satellite network app on my phone and seeing one day that one of our tagged eels had made it all the way from Western Victoria up to an area around New Caledonia, and that was after having quite a few pop off really early, only a few weeks after tagging, and that was disappointing. But then to get this one travel so far, it's brand new information on their migration ecology, and so that was a nice moment to get one make it that distance.
How long will your project go for? How long will it run for you to have enough data, or will there never be enough data, but you'll have to do with what you get type thing?
Oh, there's never enough data. well, it depends if I can get funding to continue it, and funding for reels, it's a really hard space. They sort of fall between the gaps. There's a commercial industry for reels, but it's not huge. Recreationally, as an angling species, they're not highly popular. So they don't tend to attract the level of funding that other species do.
What about their cultural values and aspects? Is that something that can help along those lines?
Yeah, look, eels are really important culturally, not only in Australia, but in many countries around the world. And some of this work has been funded in that space. So we had a DELP Indigenous Biodiversity Partnership Fund, and as part of that, we're working with Bujibim Rangers down at Lake Conda, which was recently listed as a World Heritage Area for its significance in terms of the eel aquaculture systems. And so as part of that, we've worked together with the rangers, collecting eels and tagging eels and writing up reports and so on. So, yeah, there are occasionally opportunities in that space. And hopefully there'll be some more in the future and we can keep this work going. We've really only tagged a tiny number of eels, and to get a better estimate of population level movements, it'd be great to do many, many more. If you compare that to what's happened on European eels, for example, millions and millions of dollars have been spent tracking those eels. Hundreds and hundreds of eels have been tagged in our work for the satellite tracking. We've only tagged 20 so far, so it is a small number.
Yeah.
But that said, we've got some absolute pieces of gold in terms of where they go, what happens along the way in terms of predation by sharks and whales.
Yeah.
And that sort of information is really useful for management. Typically, stock assessments and quotas for eels are based on the numbers that migrate out of rivers. They're not based on the numbers that actually make it to the spawning grounds. And so factoring that in and getting a handle on how many actually make it there can be really useful in terms of those management guidelines.
Yeah. Yeah. So part of this project, it was a joint collaboration with, so is it Glenelg, Hopkins, CMA, Melbourne Water, and is it Gadjimarra traditional owners?
Gundijmarra.
Gundijmarra.
Yeah, so we've spent a lot of time working over west around Lake Conda and the yep. Dartlets Creek system, and looking at out-migration of eels from Lake Conda. So that's using the acoustic transmitters, and we're trying to understand when eels leave that lake system and what are the environmental factors that drive it, and also how they get out of the lake. Back in 2010, as part of the Lake Conda Biodiversity Restoration Project, a weir was built to essentially re-establish the lake, but it forms a barrier.
Yep.
A fishway was then put in to allow fish to migrate out of the lake, but a lot of the time it's dry. There is an underground pipe where eels can potentially get out, so we wanted to know how are eels getting out of the lake. Are they moving through the fishway? What do they do when it's dry? Do they move through the pipe? And so we found that they move mostly through the fishway when the lake's spilling during those wetter phases, and during the drier phases, some seem to get out through the underground pipe. And often it's associated with changes in water levels in the lake. So maintaining variability in lake levels is something that we can do to cue those migrations out of the lake.
So what aspect of the project have the traditional owners been involved in? Is it utilising sort of their ancestral aquaculture knowledge, and how has the project sort of benefited from that knowledge?
I think, like, personally, one of the things I've really got out of it is just learning about some of the traditional knowledge and the culture, things like how the timing of the flowering of certain plants like acacias was a sign that eels were at their fattest and it was the best time to harvest them. So that's something I've got out of it. And then we've also done a lot of work together out in the field collecting eels using nets and then tagging eels. So there's been this exchange of information along the way. And we've even been lucky enough to do some joint interviews with the ABC recently. We managed to feature in a landline program. And so it was great that a group of us got a chance to speak about the project.
Yeah, that is fantastic. I have noted that you guys have been quite out there in the press for sure. There's been a few different articles up, which we'll include in the links and below the podcast link in the website.
Yeah, it's great that people are so interested in eels. As I mentioned before, they do tend to fall through the gaps when it comes to research and monitoring, but there's certainly a lot of community interest out there. I think they're really fascinating because there's so much mystery around what they do, undertake these huge migrations. We don't really know exactly where they go.
Do they suffer from any diseases? Like, you know how with corroboree frogs and other frogs, there can be like chytrid fungus disease. Is there anything like that that affects eels, or are they?
Yeah, there is. There's a parasitic nematode which originated from the Japanese eel, and it was introduced into Europe and has really hit the European eel stocks. That impacts on the swim bladder, which plays a really important role in terms of regulating their depth when swimming.
Yep.
I don't think that's present in Australia, and it's really important it doesn't get here, because it's thought to be a key factor in the decline of European eels.
All right, interesting. So as we wrap up, is there anything about this project, like what will this knowledge sort of help contribute to in terms of actions? Is it going to help contribute towards better improved fish passage or barrier removal, or what's the sort of hope?
I think in terms of actively managing eel populations right now, we know that barrier removal and fishways to allow migration are really important, and that can potentially benefit eel populations and other fish. The links between water levels and river flows are really important in terms of ensuring adequate water is available in the environment to allow those processes to occur. And the information we have on migration is also important in that it provides us with a way of estimating or understanding potential interactions between developments in the marine environment and how eels might be impacted by those. There's been a lot of concern, for instance, by commercial fishers around seismic testing in the marine environment for gas and oil reserves.
Yep.
Reports of reduced fish catches. What impact those sorts of activities have on eels? We don't really know, because we don't know very well what pathways they're taking. So getting information on where they go and what routes they take can be important in terms of understanding what impact those sorts of activities might be having.
Yeah. Do you think that would then lead to partnerships with more sort of marine organisations between the freshwater marine, so that you could maybe with Grumpa or somebody up north, or even a group from New Caledonia or elsewhere where they might be migrating to, do you think there could be a partnership there where you would then work with them to find out what's happening once they do get there, for those that do make it?
Yeah, we're certainly keen to maintain and expand this work, and there's certainly scope for collaborations. There's a lot of work done in that Western South Pacific region on other species like tuna, but as part of that there's occasionally eels are encountered, or larval eels, so that there's scope to potentially tap into that sort of information and expand the nature of the work that we're doing.
Yep. No, that sounds fantastic. So is there anything else you'd like to share with everybody today? Any last thoughts before we finish up?
Do you want me to tell you why they breed in the sea, or do you want me to tell you?
Oh, if you've got it and you want to share it, tell us.
Yeah, yep. So essentially why these freshwater eels migrate out and breed in the sea is thought to relate to their evolutionary history. So freshwater eels are all thought to have originated in the marine environment in the tropics around what is present-day Indonesia, and then they've dispersed from there across the globe. And so one theory is that over time, glass eels, which is the juvenile stage, have occasionally ventured from the oceans into the lower reaches of rivers or estuaries, and then they return back to the ocean as adults to breed. And some have ventured further upstream into freshwater and again return back to the ocean as breed. And so that's led to the development of that life cycle where they move between freshwater and the ocean. And so essentially they've retained that link back to those marine spawning grounds.
Yeah. That's interesting. Makes you think a lot about evolution and how things have occurred over time.
Yeah, there's some really interesting information on why eels occur where they do as well. So essentially their distribution globally relates to tropical ocean circulation, areas that are subject to warm westward flowing currents, which transport their larvae to the mostly east coast of continents, with some exceptions. So essentially those those tropical ocean currents play a major role in explaining the distribution of eels across the world.
So do you think that climate change has a role to play in the eel life cycle and migration in terms of like warming ocean currents? Like how do you think that might affect them?
Yeah, it certainly can. For the downstream migration phase in freshwater, changes to patterns in rainfall have the potential to influence out-migration patterns. We know that eels have a strong link to changes or increases in river flows. So under a drier climate, that might impact on their out-migrations and the silvering process. In the marine environment, there's also potential for impacts in terms of changes to ocean currents and salinity structure, which might influence the suitability of spawning areas and the survival of larvae. The larval eels feed on marine snow, which is essentially debris from planktonic material, and the availability of that food source is thought to be linked to temperature patterns. And so under a warming climate, there is a concern that the availability of those food sources might change or alter.
There is quite a bit we've covered today. We've found out a bit more about the project itself, about eels and their life cycle and their migration, travelling up to 3,000 kilometres all the way to New Caledonia. And it's been great, and we've loved learning about this project. And there is, as I said before, quite a bit of press and stories out there, which we'll share in our links. So I'd just like to say thank you, Wayne, for joining us on the RBMS streaming podcast today. And thank you to our listeners for joining us in the conversation. And if you found the episode informative or have any feedback, please share, like, or send us your thoughts on our social media pages, and stay tuned for the next episode.
Thanks for having me.